Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Big win for President Trump yesterday, the Ohio Republican Senate primary, that hotly contested primary to replace the outgoing Rob Portman in Ohio, and the Trump-backed J.D. Vance, or J.D. Mandel, as he called him at the rally a couple weeks back.
Name mashup.
Delaware County. J.D. Vance winning, stretching out a narrow lead looking into Election Day into about an 8-point victory. Plurality of the vote, obviously, because of the number of candidates and the competitive nature of it. But a win nonetheless. And this is interesting because this is only the second primary of the season. I mean, in addition to Indiana yesterday. And the question is, will Trump be a kingmaker in this cycle and beyond, and then perhaps try to be the king again? And the answer in Ohio is yeah. And it's all the more telling because you had Ted Cruz and Club for Growth endorse the second place finisher, Josh Mandel.
312-642-5600, turnkey top pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Trump's star power still alive, don't you think?
Well, that's the question. I mean, that was answered in Ohio because it was, I mean, J.D. Vance was competitive, but he was down, and then Trump endorsed him, and the rally took place. And he shot up, as much as I understand, 11 points. And then the attacks came from the candidates, and, you know, that had some impact, but clearly not enough to change the outcome in the race. Does Trump's endorsement of a candidate matter to you? Do you look to him to say, okay, this is somebody that I'm going to support, or at least give the benefit of the doubt if Trump is behind him? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Because the other thing going on here is a bit of a riff. So as I said, Club for Growth, run by former Congressman David McIntosh, is...
it reminds me of a hair club company, but yes, Club for Growth.
Backed Josh Mandel, and Ted Cruz endorsed Mandel. And so now you have sort of Cruz and, well, Cruz world to some extent, opposing Trump and losing. And there was a back and forth between McIntosh and Trump on this race because Trump reached out when he was told Club for Growth was endorsing Mandel and said, Dave, you know, Dave, what are you doing? And McIntosh basically said, you know, this was baked in the cakes. We're not, you know, saying anything negative about you. And then he saw a commercial where there was something negative about him. And he sent a note back to McIntosh saying, I saw the ad, and he invited McIntosh to go make love to himself. So tensions rising within some factions in the GOP in this primary season. And that's just the first one. We haven't gotten to fun primaries like Pennsylvania, that Senate race where Trump has curiously endorsed Dr. Oz. We haven't gotten to the Illinois governor's race and so many other primaries. But that Trump stamp of approval as of the Ohio primary results yesterday, that has currency. And J.D. Vance, do we hear what J.D. Vance had to say yesterday?
No, we don't have it. Oh. But we're efforting it right now.
Okay. Well,
but he's young, 37 years old. Compared to the Democrats in Washington right now, that's he's a newbie. Well, he's a youngin', Dan.
Well, the age is minor, you know, modestly interesting, but of course it's the market position, particularly from where J.D. Vance was on Trump a few years ago, and this was part of the rub, that he was critical of Trump and Trump supporters, and Trump even mentioned that. This was actually showed some growth on Trump's part, I thought, when he mentioned at the rally, you know, people say he was, how could you endorse him? He said bad things about you, and Trump basically said, look, if I didn't endorse anybody who said bad things about me, I couldn't endorse anybody. And it was a nice self-effacing moment for him. But Vance has really been aggressively America first, at least since announcing for Senate. And maybe that's a little bit of a deathbed conversion, but it worked. He's been a fixture on Tucker Carlson's show. I mean, he comes with some celebrity because of the success of his book, Hillbilly Elegy, which was turned into that movie starring Glenn Close and Amy Adams that you probably saw or at least heard about. So he comes with some cachet, but it's not that cachet that put him over the top. It's the hard line he took against the Beltway establishment, including a lot of Republicans, and including on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, where he has been very reticent to throw all in with Zelensky and the Ukrainians. Not that he's a Russian asset, and not that he's not doesn't believe that Ukraine has the right to defend itself and self-determination, all in all of those basics. But he has been skeptical of the military-industrial complex and the Beltway establishment and their blank checks and open-ended military commitments to Ukraine. And it's interesting how that played out in that primary in, here in the Rust Belt, given the enthusiasm in so many other quarters, with including the Republican ranks, for said blank check and said open-ended military commitment. Craig in Mount Greenwood, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy, and thank you much for taking my call. Listen, there's something going on that I don't know what you would call this, but and I'm one of them, and there's a whole bunch of us. Guys at work that never were voted for Trump, but then people that voted for Trump and were very outspoken in the past, we're all quiet. We're just laying in the weeds. This stuff like all the shenanigans, and especially things like what you see with January 6th and stuff like that. So there's a lot of people that have no idea how we're just laying there. When it comes time to be able to vote for Trump, we will be coming out of the weeds like you
well,
have no
yeah, but,
idea.
But, yeah, okay. But so when you say when it comes time to vote for Trump, do you look at that Ohio Senate race and say, as a Trump supporter, my opportunity to vote for Trump right now is to vote for J.D. Vance or in any other state, whoever Trump endorses? Is that how you look at it?
Yes. Yes. That's exactly it. He's Trump's got so much support now. And then with all the shenanigans with the voting and all that, Dan, you have no idea, because I've got like neighbors and people that were on the fence, people that were not real, they won't come out. Like if you do a survey, they won't even tell anything. Matter of fact, I talked to a couple people. I said, oh yeah, I screw these people around when they would do the survey about Trump and all that stuff like that. I tell them all kinds of bullcrap for me. And meanwhile, super strong to vote for Trump. I've seen it to an extent that I'm thinking to myself, if Trump, whatever Trump says, he's got plenty of support there, but a lot of secret agents. Lots of secret agents.
All right. Thanks for the call, Craig. I mean, clearly, that was a real test yesterday. And I know there are many within the Republican ranks, sort of the never Trump self-styled conservatives, as well as the establishment types that really wanted to see Mandel win. And also those who have their own aspirations for the White House, like Ted Cruz, that wanted to debunk the notion that Trump still has currency, that he is the de facto head of the party, that he can be a kingmaker, and it didn't happen.
Well, I'll see him tonight, so I'll let you know what he says.
Oh, you're going to hang out with him for the screening of D'Souza's movie.
Yeah, 2,000 Mules. That'll be tonight at Mar-a-Lago. Myself, Sean from Elmwood Park, you got an invitation, but
I've been to Mar-a-Lago.
But he's going to be there, and then he's going to speak after the movie.
Oh, okay, so. Well, you kids have fun.
Thanks.
Vincent St. Charles.
I'll get his reaction.
Good morning. Good morning, guys. Yes, Trump helps big time. And also, don't beat him up, because if you beat him up, you're not going to get my vote. It's that simple. You're not going to get a lot of our votes. Mm-hmm. Trump has brought me there mainly to the party and a lot of people. So if you beat up Trump, he's the party now. He is.
All right.
I love his style. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Vince.
Mm-hmm. What he did with the appointments to the Supreme Court. Took some time to appreciate him for that yesterday. And then, you know, what he did for small businesses and what he did for a lot of Americans.
Mike in Plano.
Hey, guys. You know, I'm really disappointed in those groups and those Republican politicians that endorsed Josh Mandel, because J.D. Vance was a much better candidate. Not only did he strike the right chord on policy, but he struck the right chord on tone. He's very measured when he speaks. And Josh Mandel, this is a guy who almost got into a fist fight with a 70-year-old primary opponent.
Yeah, that was not a good moment for him.
No.
Right.
Yeah, that should have sank his campaign. And all Gibbons did was criticize his lack of private sector experience. And he tried to counter with saying, oh, well, I served in Iraq. Well, military service isn't private sector experience, and he wasn't attacking your military service. Gibbons himself has kids in the military, or at least one that I know of.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Mike. Don't forget, you know, the Vance story, if you've read Hillbilly Elegy or you know a little bit about the story, so I've seen the movie, is going from Appalachia to Yale Law. So, I mean, you know, Vance is a smart guy, there's no question. Tom in Deer Park.
Oh, good morning, Dan and Amy. I have voted in Republican primaries my entire life in Illinois. I've never missed an election, general, or a primary in Illinois. And I'm also in a distinct minority in what's left of the conservative movement in the Republican Party. If President Trump endorses a candidate and that candidate accepts the endorsement, that candidate might get my support. And it's got nothing to do with mean tweets, orange hair, personality. I'm on a different level. And like I said, I'm in a distinct minority with your audience, Republican Party, and the rest of the conservative movement.
All right, Tom, thanks for the call. It was breaking up a little bit, but he said if in case people didn't catch it, he knows he's in a distinct minority, but if whoever Trump endorses, if that candidate accepts his endorsement, he would not support that candidate. And it's not because of mean tweets or orange hair.
Okay. Nice translation.
Well, that's
you're really good at that.
The summary. Tom in Blue Island.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Big fan of Craig from Mount Greenwood. As a Mount Greenwood guy, I'm not following Trump down any specific rabbit hole. Vance, although imperfect, he kind of fits the MAGA moniker a little bit. He's an outsider. The Ukraine war, despite feeling terrible for them people, it's very troublesome that the left all has lined up with it. And so it's not to be, you know, then you get called pro-Russia if you question anything. And just to finish it, what Craig said, I would never vote for Dr. Oz, Dan, as you mentioned it. He's come out as being pro-abortion. So as a big Trump supporter, I'd listen to his recommendations, but then I think Trump supporters are going to make their own decisions. He's not God.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Tom. No, I agree. And if I was in Pennsylvania, I wouldn't be voting for Dr. Oz either. But I think something that I think it was Vince in St. Charles said, I think it's, you know, you can disagree with them. You can go a different way in a particular race or for a particular candidate. But if you attack him as some boogeyman that the way the left does, then you lose. Then you lose people within the GOP ranks. And I can tell you from polling I've seen in Illinois, that's true here, too. People think that this Republican primary electorate is more liberal because it's in Illinois. It's not. This primary electorate's been scammed a few times, unfortunately. Made some bad decisions on the whole a few times, many times over the last couple of decades, actually, unfortunately. But 3/4 identify as conservative. Trump's approval rating among Republican primary voters?
What?
91-5. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that. So there's no question that Trump's opinion in these races matters. It mattered in Ohio. It's going to continue to matter.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
All right, we were just talking about it, the new documentary from Dinesh D'Souza and executive produced by Salem Media Group, 2,000 Mules. It's in theater screenings in Chicagoland, the ones that are here.
2,000 Mules or 2,000 Mules?
2,000 Mules.
Oh, yeah.
Let me try that again.
There's a
it's called 2,000 Mules.
Yeah.
And all of the in-theater screenings in Chicagoland for this week are sold out. But you can still experience this film from the comfort of your own home by being part of a virtual premiere on Saturday, May 7th. You'll be able to see the film and participate in a live Q&A with Dinesh D'Souza, Eric Metaxas, Larry Elder, and others. Here's what you do. Be part of the virtual premiere this Saturday by going to 2000mules.com. That's 2000mules.com.
All right, Triple Threat and Jelly Belly have come together to make a pitch for Chicago to host the Democrat Socialist National Convention in 2024. I think that's a good idea. I mean, we didn't get the Olympics in 2016, so this is the next best thing a little less than a decade later. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line, and they got their whole marketing team together.
Yeah, they got Common to narrate it. They put together a video, of course, highlighting Barack Obama and others.
Rise Strategy Group is the consultant. And this is interesting. I did a little look-see at who they are. Their president and founder is a former comms director for Tiny Dancer. They got a former comms director for Eric Garcetti, the mayor of L.A. You know, this is really interesting. And this agitprop has a ring of somebody that would have been comms directors or some people who had been comms directors for mayors like Tiny Dancer and Garcetti.
Our future is created right here by every single Chicagoan who chooses to see what we can be and achieve, by the resilience deeply rooted in our history and the strength gained from every single victory, by the vibrant neighborhoods up north, south, east, and west, 77 to be exact, each with unique history, sounds, and tastes, from Pilsen, Logan Square, Avalon Park, to Chinatown, Ravenswood,
please mention back my neighborhood.
Of the yards,
Street
of Hills. We're
home
to
many, many communities that provide all kinds of opportunities.
So
all
schlocky.
The diversity that unites
diversity
us, connects us.
It's equity.
That brings out
we're
the
all,
best.
Well,
in
we're
us.
All in this together, right?
Every face, every age, every race,
all
different types of populations that make us one city representing one nation. By all our flavors that are exciting and unique.
Because we've got
music,
great restaurants.
Art, comedy, festivals. That's all in our mystique. By all the monuments that make our tourism iconic.
Except Columbus.
Historical, botanical, architectonic. Imagining, planning, building, advancing. Leading a battle on voting rights. Advocating to preserve all civil rights. Suppression, oppression, we're fighting for equality. It's why we're known as the heartland of democracy.
Chicago's known as the heartland of democracy.
Boy, are?
That may be the most laughable sentence in the whole 2.5 minute pitch.
That's
but pretty exciting. The city that he's talking about called Chicago. I mean, I live in Chicago. I don't know exactly what City Common is referencing there. I know the quick cuts, and they're exciting and fun.
It looks,
And I know what Chicago used to be, but I thought we were pitching what Chicago is today. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Look, if socialists from around the country want to come to Chicago and see
How bad it is and the boarded up windows on Michigan Avenue.
Well, see how adroit they are in dodging bullets, then, you know, come on.
I mean, we've got Circle of Fire on Lower Wacker on the weekends, you know, drag racing, you name it, we have it.
It's part of the tastes and the diverse tastes and flavors that you find in the city. Absolutely. Jim and DeKalb, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Well, you guys kind of segued me right in there. I was thinking the most perfect thing would be to have them right, you know, I want them on the doorstep so you can expose every single thing about what Democratic Party has done to the city of Chicago. Yeah, have them right there. Have them walk around. Have them go through the city from the north side to the south side. Of course, they'll stop at the 290. They won't go any more south than that. But yes, yeah.
I think they'll stop.
You want your enemies closer, right?
Yeah, thanks for the call, Jim. I think they'll stop about State Street.
Oh, you think?
About State and Madison, as I think. I don't think they're going south.
Really? You're right.
What do you mean? You think they're going to take a walkthrough of Inglewood, or
no.
Are they going to go out west in Austin? Or
no, they'll stop as far as...
I mean, I know, Commons talking about the south side and the west side and the east side, and it's all very exciting.
And no one's going to the east side.
Some of it
side.
Is much less exciting than other parts of it. And by the way, frankly, all of it's a little bit too exciting, at least if you're... You know, want a life and death experience, or you're looking to avoid, more to the point, a life and death experience. Brian in Chesterton, Indiana.
Hey, how you doing, guys? Love your show.
Thank you.
I was just commenting on Lightfoot wanting to bring the DNC to Chicago. She can't even keep her own citizens safe. She hates the police. She lets the Black Lives Matter riots go on, like, doesn't even bat an eye about that. But then she wants to bring more people here. It just makes no sense to me. I can't believe she even has the guts to do this, to even want this.
I know. And then, no days off for police officers during that time, I'm sure. And they can't stop BLM from marching and protesting.
Well, look, I mean, on behalf for the restaurants and the businesses that rely on tourism as part of their business model, convention halls and so forth. I mean, although I don't really care what happens at McCormick Place anymore. Because that's just another institution the kleptocrats have corrupted. But I understand it. I understand. Yeah, of course. I mean, I want the businesses to be successful. A lot of great restaurants and so forth. So, yeah, trying to bring people in, I get it. And in point of fact, Chicago is the perfect city for DNC 2024 because it should be amplified. The nation should see
what they've done to us.
We've done.
Yep.
We have implemented every Democrat socialist policy that's been proposed over the last 50 years. And what's the impact? Mass exodus, general lawlessness, commercial rents down 25%. Second highest debt per capita of big cities behind only New York. Schools where a fourth of the kids can read or do math at grade level. Those are just some of the lowlights. So please, come on in, international media.
Well, what happened in Milwaukee? I mean, they were scheduled to have it in 2020, but COVID happened. But why wouldn't they go back there?
Well, who cares about Milwaukee? We'll talk about Chicago. Why wouldn't they go back there? Oh, they may go back there. They haven't committed to Chicago.
Okay. Still on the
point
side.
Is, come here and tell those stories. A challenge to the international media. Tell about Chicago. Tell us. Make sure the world knows that Chicago has more murders than New York and L.A. combined, with one sixth of the combined population. One sixth of the population of those two combined cities. Why is that? Tell the story. All of the tastes and flavors that Common spoke of, put them on display. Don't just give me a picture of a boat on the architectural tour. Tell the real story of Chicago, why don't you? And how we got here. Chris and on the Dan Ryan.
Hey, Dan and Amy. It's funny because I listened to, on the way home last night, to the other sister station, WLS. CEO of the hotels and motels, whatever they want to call it nowadays, and he even said that, you know, he can't wait for the DNC to come here. He goes, I understand that there's lots of challenges that Chicago is facing right now, but I know that we'll pull it together before the DNC comes in. So you just admitted that the city has turned into a hellhole, but we're going to get it together before this happens? Yeah, I don't think so. I think that this is a crock, and I hope we don't get it. Bottom line.
All right, thanks for the call, Chris. Yeah, we're going to pull it together before the Olympics. We're going to pull it together before the DNC in 2024. We're going to pull it together. It's magically going to get pulled together. We're not going to elect anybody different. We're not going to make any pivots policy-wise, but it's going to come together. It always comes together for Chicago, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Does it? Is that what it looks like? Is what we're having now coming together? Oh, by the way, with all of the rich diversity and the neighborhoods and the flavors and the taste.
And the sleek video, yes.
Yeah, it's not a sleek video. It's a hack job is what it is. Very unimpressive as a communication product, actually. But most de facto segregated city in the country, arguably. Tell me again about the wonderful diversity with everybody coming together. One city that represents one nation. Yeah. No. No, it's not. No, it's not, because we have allowed ourselves to be balkanized by race-hustling, identitarian politicians. That may be the saddest part of Chicago, is that it is not one city.
Well, the Democrats need to see what they created. And they can live in fear for that week.
Black Americans here and Latinos there and whites there. And yeah, that's the city. A balkanized city. One city. We're all in it together. Yeah, no, we're not. Spare me. It's just not true. And anybody who lives in Chicago knows it. And I don't care what your political or ideological affiliation is. So, yeah, come on, socialists. Come to Chicago. I know you don't like guns, so you better bring your security guards. Matt in Mount Greenwood.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I was having a conversation with one of our executives who's out of our Dallas office. We're in the construction business, and he had no idea of the violence in Chicago and the exodus of people and how this has affected business and tourism. He was just dumbstruck, and this is related to the lack of construction jobs. Relative to one specific trade. And it's a barometer of what's happening politically. So, again, bring it on so we can shine the spotlight on this once great city.
Absolutely.
Have a good day.
Thanks for the call, Matt. Yeah. Bring the cameras so the international reaction will be, what the hell happened to Chicago?
Yeah.
Anthony and Darian.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I think all those statistics you rattled off, that's loser talk. Safety, security, fiscal responsibility. Instead of that, we need to bring back that dreadhead cowboy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Get a Lunu out there on the Dan Ryan. Or maybe he could just peruse through Grant Park.
The census cowboy?
Yeah.
I think he's up for the task. He's probably looking for a gig. Randy Sandwich.
I'm about that, too.
Guys, I hate to bring it back to reality, but this is exactly how this dog and pony show is going to go. Somewhere up on the sixth floor, there's a file that showed what Daley did, where he dialed up one route for everybody to drive on so we could all see how great Chicago is. And it was fortified with police on both sides, where there was no way anybody could penetrate the barrier. And everybody's going to think that Chicago's great, but all you have to do is venture off the path, like when you go to a vacation in Mexico where it's not in the tour section, and you'll see the real reality of how things are on the ground.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're right, Randy. Thanks for the call. If it comes, they'll set up the Potemkin Village. And they'll, you know, keep the media cordoned off from the real Chicago as much as they can. But that's the challenge. That's the challenge. By the way, you know, you're always want to focus on the negative, Amy. And I like to look for the silver linings, the positives, the great things. Remember the great things about Chicago. Focus in on what Chicago has to offer.
Yeah.
You know, like Chicago.
Oh, that's right.
Chicago.
It's the newest venture, because Chicago tap water is so good that they're bottling it up.
They rolled out Chicago yesterday.
And today we are building upon and taking pride in its history by launching a new project that brings awareness to the vital resource along our shore, Chicago, yeah. A brand new way for branding our drinking water. Chicago is a brand that celebrates Chicago's unique access to the world's largest freshwater sources in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
Chicago.
Good.
And the can is a really cool design can.
Oh, yeah.
It's got a body floating down the Chicago River.
Oh, we stop. It's different artists who've drawn up designs. So each can is unique, Dan, for Chicago. Come on, I'm thirsty.
Interestingly, Chicago is how Mayor Richard M. Daley had always pronounced Chicago. So I think that's where she stole it from. Cans will a free yes. Chicago if you're out and about in Chicago. I recommend during daylight hours.
But not even safe then.
No,
but okay.
Still keep your head on a swivel. I agree.
I'm packing, man. I'm ready for you.
The cans of Chicago will be available for free at various events through the city this summer, as well as for all those block parties you want to go to. They'll also be in locations around the city, including at Real Good Stuff Company, Wiener Circle, Manny's, the institutions, Manny's, Wiener Circle, so Chicago, Commons, Home, he doesn't live here anymore, Jim Belushi's home, he doesn't,
live here.
Bill Murray, he's in Charleston. Who do we have left? Who's our resident celebrity? Oh, John Cusack. John Cusack,
No, I thought he moved to Evanston.
Oh.
Well, Joan did, because she used to live in West Greece.
Oh, who do we have?
Jerry Springer, no, he left.
Are any of the guys from Chicago Fire, do they live here?
No, they don't.
How about Chicago PD?
No, they don't. They just.
How about Empire? Is Jussie Smollett still here?
Jussie Smollett?
He's looking for a gig. Spokesman for Chicago. You know,
he could be.
He has a nice can of Chicago to wash down the tuna subs he gets from Subway. That's a good commercial.
Two in the morning when it's minus 27 degrees out.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. COVID is not over. It's not over. Pandemic is not over. You know how I know that?
How?
Because I was looking at all the things you have to fill out, all the paperwork you have to fill out for a block party. I'm going to throw a little block party in Streeterville.
Oh, you are?
No.
I'm supposed to do that. I'm supposed to meet with the block captain to fill it out. What do I have to endure? We're going to have it the weekend before CPS starts.
The block captain, who else are you meeting with?
Well, I already wrote an email to the alderman to get a permit pulled for the event.
Keep going. Who are you missing?
Mayor Lightfoot?
No. Mm-mm.
Dr. Awarde?
No.
Is Dr. Mziki back?
No.
What?
You can't have a block party.
Without Chug Chug the Comeback Clown?
No, although that's a good feature. You can't fill out a block party application if you don't have your COVID captain.
You have to have a COVID captain?
You have to have a... Well, who's going to fill out the COVID safety affirmation form?
Oh, this is getting good. I don't know if I have time for that, but...
Well, you're going to make time if you want a block party.
They wouldn't have a block party last year. I tried, and none of my neighbors. One of all the homes on our block, one neighbor wanted a block party. I said, well, you and I could just sit out front in our lawn chairs and talk.
But if the COVID captain says it's okay.
Oh, no. Do I have to get a cape if I'm going to be a COVID captain?
Look... Know your COVID captain. This is more important than your precinct captain for a garbage can in days of yore. Everybody know their COVID captain in their neighborhood? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. It's right here, the COVID-19 safety affirmation form. The COVID captain must sign this COVID-19 safety affirmation form with the permit application that attests they will check... Recommend vaccinations for all who attend. Check, communicate that unvaccinated individuals, including children not eligible for the vaccine, wear masks and maintain social distancing.
Outside at a block party?
I'm not done. Three, ensure ready access to hand sanitizer throughout the block party. You have to commit to this program and test to it before, not before God, before an institution more important, City Hall. If you want to submit a block party application and have any chance that block party application will be approved.
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Maybe I could hire the Rona Busters to be our COVID captains.
Well,
my God, I could see if Dr. Wardy and, you know, because sometimes they hang out at block parties.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, you really want this is like a sergeant at arms for the neighborhood. You want the COVID captain to be part of the neighborhood, you know, for safety purposes, as to be somebody that lives there. So you always have a COVID captain in the neighborhood you can rely on for safety tips, protocols, updates on whether we're like in the purple zone or the tangerine zone. Or
we're doing medium, low, high now.
All right, whatever the magic eight ball says.
Bridge.
Right, I got it. So, yeah. So
oh, I know.
You got to have a COVID captain.
So if we have a COVID captain and all that, people are not going to have a block party. Because cases are on the rise right now.
Oh, yeah.
And I have some news for you, Dan.
Yeah.
Masks may be coming back.
For block parties, they are. For the unvaccinated, I know that.
Well, in general, for indoor spaces, here's Dr. Allison Awardy.
We probably will turn from low to medium risk.
Uh-oh.
However, we are currently only planning to put mask requirements in place at a high risk level.
And that means for all indoor places, gyms, theaters, restaurants, schools.
But that's,
here we go a frickin' again.
Well, that's only if her crystals indicate that we're at high level.
Well, right now, every day, 700 plus Chicagoans are testing positive right now for COVID.
I don't know what that means.
Well, because normally if we are 300 and below, that's when we got rid of the masks.
Why?
Because the crystal ball said so.
Okay.
All okay, because
right. Well, that's a good answer.
Well, that's because they change it. It's so, you know, they change the rules all the time and the measurements. But here's the deal that you guys need to know. Only 12 Chicagoans are hospitalized and less than one person a day is dying from COVID. So why are we going back to the silly masks?
Well, she didn't say that.
Once we get, because we're moving from low to medium and then medium when we get into high, it's all over.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Who's going back to that? And they're still pushing for masks on public transportation and for airplanes and all sorts of everything.
Well, this is why you need a COVID captain. I mean, I can't keep track of all this. You know, it's enough to figure out whether or not you're allowed to have a bouncy house or not at the block party. So you need the COVID captain to translate the data and the science from the public health people, the men and women of science and data, and to give you, you know, to give you the green light to act as your chaperone for the block party effectively.
So, I have a bouncy house story. So the block.
You're not allowed to have bouncy houses. It's unsafe.
Well, but they did. The block.
Oh, my God.
Polina, the 3800 block of North Polina did.
You mean some adults revolted against the city and had a bouncy house at a block party?
Yeah, but then they were shamed by people walking their dogs. Like, how could you put the kids are such a close proximity. They're always in close proximity because they live together. I mean, these COVIDians.
Well, those are
they're
perfect.
Sick. This is a condition now.
That's what sounds. You know what that sounds like? It sounds like a couple of good candidates for COVID captains.
Right. Okay. Well, wait. So you're telling me I can't have a bouncy house?
You can't have a bouncy house. No. No jumping jacks or bouncy houses will be permitted at block parties.
Excuse me. What about the water slide? Because we love the water slide.
You're going to have
the inflatable water slide, climb up there. Bunky lug goes down the water slide every block.
I think you're allowed to have the slip and slide so the kids can get the feeling of slipping, you know, through that slide onto the concrete or scraping themselves like we did as kids. But no, I don't know. It doesn't
say. What about face painting? Or is that too close?
I would consult your COVID captain on these matters. That's why they're there.
You don't understand. I have to arrange my block. I'm a community organizer, Dan.
How do you think it's going to go when the COVID captain, if somebody is brave enough to do this, asks people for their vaccination status and then tells people who say, I'm unvaccinated, that they have to wear a mask, including their kids? How do you think that's going to go? Do you think that's going to promote a neighborhood comity? You think that's gonna? Is that gonna be part of being one Chicago?
Excuse me, Mr. Proft. I have a great idea.
What? I'm going to be COVID captain in my neighborhood.
No, and since I'm in charge of my block party, I would like you to be the COVID captain and throw it back in their face because they've been, you know, just most of them have been unbearable and rude and shooting daggers through their eyes if you're not wearing a mask outside and all that stuff. So you could come to my hood and you could be the COVID captain. It's like, vaccination card, please. Mask, please.
There is no way that I could last more than 5 minutes hanging out with your neighbors in Lakeview. I can't do it.
Well, the one that it was the
I can't
Republican,
do it peacefully.
He moved. Yeah. They moved right away. They saved themselves and their children.
I appreciate the offer, and it would be fun, but...
Can we have karaoke? Because we always have karaoke at our block.
Yeah, again, the COVID captain, that's the answer there. I don't know if you have to mask because, you know, you're projecting when you're singing. Those are questions for COVID captain. I don't have the credentials to answer these questions.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Taylor, Northside.
Dan, I'm wondering if you could be our COVID captain this week, and I'm going on a bachelorette party down in Siesta Key. Are we in the purple zone on Friday? Are we in the orange zone? The girls were kind of wondering, so we were hoping you could be our captain.
Oh, that's captain, my captain. Oh,
Sarah Taylor. Yeah.
Now you're expanding from block parties. Now you're going to bachelorette parties.
Yes.
All right. Well, so you just get me. Hold on, Taylor. We'll get your information. I could be in Sarasota. And, of course, COVID captains are prohibited in the state of Florida.
Yes, you guys exercise this thing called common sense that we used to have that is gone now.
Thanks so much for the offer, Taylor. Wow. Makes an old man feel good.
At the age of 50.
Oh, thanks for the reminder.
Yeah. There's your happy birthday balloon.
Joe in Naperville.
Yeah, I'm gonna
happy birthday balloon is going to outlive me. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Joe.
That's okay. I'm going to wager that the punishment for a COVID captain not following the rules is going to be worse than a thug doing shoot-ups with being a mutual combatant.
Yeah, right. Thanks for the call, Joe. I can't wait for the first COVID captain who signs forges a signature or signs the form incorrectly to be prosecuted by Kim Fox.
Oh, exactly. Mm. Is somebody going to be monitoring the COVID captains? Or this is just you?
I assume you'll have a whole, you know, COVID bureaucracy like we have for those traffic signal helpers who mimic the traffic signals. Something like that. That's a pretty good model. Because you have to have supervisors. You have to have assistant directors. You have to have a director.
Are we going to be unionized?
Probably. CIU, I'm sure. They're happy to get their meat hooks into the COVID captains. Tom and Berwyn.
Hey, morning, Dan and Amy. I'm the COVID colonel here in Berwyn, and they gave me the liquid version of the vaccine. I'm just putting it into the egg salad, not telling anybody. So you guys are invited to come out on Mother's Day, okay?
Oh, my God, I love you.
Colonel Tom, thanks for that. He's pulling rank. Yeah. Oh. COVID colonel in Berwyn. Maybe.
Oh, they're still, sorry.
You know, I think that's a good idea. I think it should be military ranks in the bureaucracy.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the general, their secretary general of the COVID force.
I'm the one. I'm going to be the COVID captain. I can't
you
wait because I want to know about everyone's vaccination status.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure they'll be happy to tell you.
Oh, yeah.
Felix in Mount Prospect.
A word on their chest.
Hey, well, Dan, if you're going to be heading down to the Siesta Key to that bachelorette party, I think you should just go down there, take your mask and only your mask.
There you go.
Oh, hey.
Yeah, right.
Hey, wear your mask where you want,
thanks
if you know what
call,
I mean.
Felix. That's not where you wear the mask. All right. John in Crown Point.
Yeah, I heard the COVID captain has to be identified at those block parties with a special hat, and it's shaped as a dunce cap.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Thanks, John. Bill, LaSalle County.
I'm going all out.
Hi. I don't know if thanks for taking the call. I don't know if you saw. It came across the Google. Pritzker signed another executive order at the end of April extending COVID restrictions and things like that.
Yeah, well, the emergency declaration. We're still in a state of emergency. That's why we said COVID's not over. That's why you need your COVID captain to have your block party. Absolutely.
Don't get rid of your masks.
Yeah.
But you know what? Also, the state needs to get their cut out of the COVID captains. They need to have certification and licensure of the COVID captains.
Smart. Yeah, that's good. Make it a statewide program. Put it under Department of Professional Reg or whatever that is now these days. Yeah, I like it.
I have a great
good
idea.
Call. This, these are people testing. Who understand how Illinois works.
Right, but we could test people, too, to enter the street.
Well, right. And if
you know, we could do anal testing, too.
Anal swab is always my preference in terms of a test. But that's the sort of certification. It's like being a Chicago public school teacher. You go get some silly certification, and then you get a step increase. That's how you, I mean, that's how you do it. That's how you build your bureaucracy. You set them up with seven-figure guaranteed pensions. Their patronage army when election time rolls around. This is how you do it. I love it. This is going to work out well, I think. By the way, David Spade has a new stand-up special on Netflix. It's probably the last thing you want to see before you cancel Netflix in addition to the end of the final season of Ozark.
Ozarks. Are you watching it?
I'm done. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, don't.
It's done. I'm done.
Okay. Don't. I have two more episodes, so I'd appreciate it.
They all die. I'm kidding. David Spade, his stand-up special, Nothing Personal. It's pretty good. It's a little graphic, a lot of scatological humor, so for the kids. But he does go after the COVID. COVIDians a bit, including Dr. Fauci, and it's kind of fun, and it's kind of fun that you actually have comedians with some profile that are daring to veer into this space.
And then Dr. Grouchy, I've sort of had it with him. I mean, no offense, this just buzzkill, hammering me with bad news. No bedside manner. Every time I see him, he's like, "What do you think? Gonna be worse." If I had to guess, with absolutely no information, I'd bet on worse. Everything will be bad to worse to sh**. No matter what, I'm like, God, any hope, dude? Let's mix it up. Second opinion, nope. I'm your guy, and it's bad. And then they always had like a running death count in the corner, which was horrifying. I'd block it with my hand because it was such a drag, and it was the Jerry Lewis telethon. We're like, Tiffany, roll it. Oh, we hit a million. Like, that doesn't make me feel good. Grouchy, and he was always like, oh, by the way, he kept going, there's going to be a fifth wave. I warn you, fifth wave. And there was a fifth wave, and he was shitting on it. He was so happy. It came true. I was like, God damn it. He's like, back on TV, makeup. Here we go, ring light. Oh, it's going to be bad. Fifth wave, it's going to be worse than Rocky V. No, it's not. It's not going to be worse than Rocky V. What are you talking about? But you do sound like the trainer in Rocky V. This one's going to hit you by minute, Rock, by minute. It's going to put you in a body bag.
You know, it's funny. He does sound like Burgess Meredith. Fauci. I never picked up on that, but that's a pretty good observation by Spade.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
You want to hear a little bit more from David Spade?
Yes, please.
Special on COVID. He does a riff about the announcement about 6 months in that some of California would be reopening. And he also goes to the whole, like, these color codes and numbers and things that are used, to describe what state of COVID we're in.
Yes.
Yeah, take a listen.
I don't know if you've heard, but we're in the third year of our 2-week lockdown, and it's going really badly. It's very tricky to have a lockdown because about 6 months into it, I was like, any word on the 2-week lockdown? Has anyone said anything to you? Because I'm still in my house. And then our governor came out and they said he's going to have a press conference and announce he's opening things. All I want is restaurants. That's all I honestly give a fuck about. I said, great, let's do restaurants. So he comes out on TV, wastes our fucking time, because he goes, starting Monday, we're going to do the purple tier. I'm like, Awesome. No idea what that is. Let's go. Starting Monday, we're going to open rock quarries, archery repair shops. What do you say? Say archery. Decoupage centers. Caterpillar sanctuaries. What the f*** is going on? What's happening? Anything about restaurants? No, that's tangerine tier. That's...
Yeah, yeah.
You don't know this? You don't... That's...
It's about right. Yeah, he's about right. Sometimes our producer, Justin, thinks we're on Sirius XM.
Yeah.
So you'll have to excuse him.
Yes, I think he bleeped it out.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the leak of the draft opinion in the Dobbs case, you could offer the supposition that it was a long time coming. This is Senate, now Senate Majority Leader Pagliacci. You know him as Chuck Schumer. This is him at a pro-abortion rally, and that's what it is, by the way, pro-abortion. That's what Planned Parenthood is. That's what these rallies are, pro-abortion. This is Schumer in March of 2020 with a public message for Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh.
And they're taking away fundamental rights. I want to tell you, Gorsuch, I want to tell you, Kavanaugh, you have released the whirlwind and you will pay the price. You won't know what hit you if you go forward with these awful decisions.
He sounds like a madman, like he's unhinged.
Well, he is a maniac, and the mania that surrounds the promotion of abortion on the left is just ghoulish and sad and terrible, and Chuck Schumer is a good representation of that. So is that such a stretch to go from that statement from a senior leader of the Democrat Socialist Party 2 years ago to a clerk, possibly for Sotomayor? We don't know. Some supposition about that, some dots that could be connected. Is it such a leap to go from that 2 years ago to this unprecedented leaking of a draft opinion the other day?
I mean, even people on the left, like UIC law professor Ann Luzin, she said this is going to be bad because some of the Supreme Court justices could change their mind.
There are two or three people on the court who I think are going to stick with what Alito said. But there, I suspect that the new people, like Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, are going to be amazed at what's happening right now, and they may start changing their votes.
Yeah, I don't think so. If they did that, then they would have no credibility as justices, zero. So that's not going to happen. And as usual, these law professors don't know what the hell they're talking about. She's projecting something she hopes will happen rather than offering real analysis of what's going to happen. And now the push is for that opinion to be fast-tracked and released. And I'm in agreement with scholars like Andy McCarthy and others that it should be, given what someone did in putting this into the public arena and, you know, opening the door to the firestorm you knew was coming whenever the opinion was to be released, if it was going to be of the nature that it is, confirmed yesterday by Justice Roberts, that draft opinion that was leaked and published by Politico is in fact the opinion and or the draft opinion at the time, and that an investigation is underway. The big guy was asked about this matter on the tarmac, and here's what Joe Biden had to say.
Look, think what Roe says. Roe says what all basic mainstream religions have historically concluded, that that the existence of a human life and being is a question. Is it at the moment of conception? Is it 6 months? Is it 6 weeks? Is it quickening like Aquinas argued? I mean, so the idea that we're going to make a judgment that is going to say that no one can make the judgment to choose to abort a child based on a decision by the Supreme Court, I think goes way overboard.
Three things. Abort a child? That's the phrase Joe Biden used. Abort a child. Mm-hmm. Oh, so it is a child.
Yeah.
So I guess we do know when life begins, Joe. You just said it. And all the world religions, they don't know when life begins. Hey, Joe Biden, man of science, I Catholic. Point you, well, yeah, right, as ornamentation. But I point you to the work of Steve Jacobs, PhD from U of C, his study from a couple years ago we've referenced on the show a couple of times. He asked more than 5,000 academics in the field of biology when life begins. More than three quarters of them identify as left. 96% of them said at conception. Science from scientists, actual biologists, since we know that justices like Ketanji Brown Jackson aren't biologists. Oh, and by the way, the third thing. In 1982, Joe Biden proposed a constitutional amendment to overturn Roe v. Wade and allow the states to choose their own policies on abortion. Joe Biden did that. 82. So now, 40 years later, he's singing a different tune because his party's in a different place, which is classic Joe Biden. He's a company man. And for most politicians, company men and women who form at the back of the parade. Jesse Jackson was pro-life. Dick Durbin was pro-life. And then the Democrat socialists, as the sexual revolution was ramping up, decided that it was no longer tenable if they wanted to stitch together their solidarity and marginality parade of horribles to win elections and control government. That's not the path. The path is to continue attacking the nuclear family and the sum and substance of institutions that promote the core values on which this country was founded. And so they went the other direction. But it's just interesting to note the history and the change. Joe Biden wasn't, a teenager in 1982. He was in the Senate for almost a decade by that time. For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined by our friend, Dr. Ben Carson, top-selling author, former Secretary of HUD, a 2016 Republican presidential candidate, former Director of Pediatric Neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins. He's got a new book, Created Equal, The Painful Past, Confusing Present, and Hopeful Future of Race in America. Dr. Carson, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Always good to be with you. And, I was listening to your dialogue there, spot on. And, one of the things that people don't realize about abortion, you look at the greatest purveyor of abortion, Planned Parenthood, that was started by Margaret Sanger, who believed in eugenics. And how do we get rid of undesirables in our neighborhood? She was a hero in Nazi Germany and placed most of those clinics in neighborhoods where there were minorities because it was a good way to get rid of them. And I wish people would look into some of those kinds of things before they proclaimed her a hero.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the many sad facets of this, isn't it? That the people who they say they're representing, the truly vulnerable populations, the indigent and so forth, they're the ones that are actually targeting. And they've done so much, and these policies have done so much destruction in urban centers, disproportionately minority neighborhoods.
Absolutely. And a few years ago, I was in South Africa at an achievement summit, and one of the speakers was the head of the ACLU, and they were talking about how the ACLU is so wonderful, and they speak for those who can't speak for themselves, and on he went. At the end, during the question and answer period, I stood up and I said, a woman came to me. She was 32 weeks pregnant. She was on her way to Kansas to get an abortion because that was the only place that they would still do it at that stage, because 33 weeks, you're viable outside the womb without life support. And the baby had a neurological problem. I managed to convince the woman not to get the abortion, to give birth to the baby. I was able to operate on the baby. It was successful. She loves that baby. She's very glad she didn't kill it. But I said to him, did you speak for that baby? That baby has no one to speak for it and was about to be killed. He wouldn't answer the question. And later on that evening at dinner, I continued the conversation. I said, I operate on little babies at 26, 27, 28 weeks gestation.
They've already been born. They're on maximum life support. Would you speak for those babies? Oh, yeah, no problem. I said, but the one that's several weeks further advanced, you can't speak for? And he said, I realize that doesn't make any sense, but I believe a woman has the right to kill the baby until the second it is born. Wow. And I said, would you say that in public? And he said, no. Now they will say it in public. That's the level of to which our society is sinking. And we need to really speak out for those who speak for themselves. Human life, and if you've ever seen an abortion, it is heartrending. You know, you see this baby in there with a head, a face, eyes and nose, fingers and toes, the heart's beating, and that tube is introduced, and you see the baby try to move away from it before it rips off one of the arms, rips off a leg, and you see all the blood going down the tube. I mean, it is chilling to watch that. I don't know how anybody can do it.
Mm. Well, I want to get to your book as well. I mean, the pro-life fight, though. Before we do that, I mean, you talk in your book about a hopeful future for race in America. With the leak of that opinion and the debate that is now ensuing, and the left exposing itself for who it is, the pro-abort left, as you're saying, they're happy to openly say kill baby, even in some places, even after they're born, up to a certain point in time after they're born. Happy to say that in public. It is chilling. But the flip side is to say that we're moving in a direction of culture of life. We've seen a lot of action at the state level with a couple of dozen states that have moved to limit abortion, if not come very close to banning it outright. And we have an opportunity to now re-engage on the topic and educate the next generation of individuals about promoting a culture of life and about this opportunity the Supreme Court has provided.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are multiple clinics around the nation, pro-life clinics, where they have resources and ways of helping women who have become pregnant and maybe didn't intend to, with alternatives. And if they don't want to keep that baby, there are a lot of people who do want that baby. So it is not absolutely necessary to kill babies.
You know that woman that you mentioned that you said you talked her into keeping her child? Do you still talk to her?
I haven't seen her since I retired, 9 years ago. But I do run into people all the time, though, on airplanes and various places around the country who say, hey, Doc, you operated on me when I was a little baby.
Yeah.
It was really a wonderful feeling.
Yeah.
And a woman came up to my wife, and she said, beautiful, statuesque young woman. She said, are you Mrs. Carson? She said, your husband operated on me when I was still in my mother's womb, on me and my sister. And here she is, you know, completely normal, able to take care of herself. That's why nobody's going to convince me that that's a meaningless bunch of cells in someone's uterus.
Yeah, even the big guy says so, aborting a child, an excited utterance from the president. Your new book, Created Equal, The Painful Past, Confusing Present, and Hopeful Future of Race in America. You know, when we're in the midst of these battles over critical race theory curricula, and we have schools incredibly segregating by race, doing, you know, whites and blacks only assemblies and training sessions and so forth. Why should we be hopeful about the future of race in America and race relations?
Because I think people are actually starting to realize what's going on. COVID did us a favor by exposing what they were doing. Recognize that Nikita Khrushchev in the late 50s, early 60s said to Eisenhower, your grandchildren's children will live under communism and we won't have to fire a shot. What was he talking about? He knew that all you had to do is gain control of the educational system so you could indoctrinate the kids, gain control of the media so you could spoon feed the people only what you wanted them to hear, exclude what you didn't want them to hear, replace faith in God with faith in government, and raise the national debt to astronomical levels so you could justify massive taxation, redistribution of wealth, and complete dependency on the government. All of those things are happening right now, but people are finally
having a chance to see what's going on, and they are waking up. And the American people, you know, they're not docile like people in lots of other parts of the country who just allowed, you know, the dictators to take over. We're not going to do that. We're going to fight vigorously, but we need to make sure people have the material that's necessary for them to fight with. That's why American Cornerstone Institute was developed.
He is Ben Carson, a best-selling author, former HUD secretary, 2016 GOP presidential candidate, former director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins, The Gifted Hands, you remember the movie made him, and the new book, Created Equal, The Painful Past, Confusing Present, and Hopeful Future of Race in America. Dr. Carson, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
That's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So as we discussed a bit earlier in the program, big win for J.D. Vance in that Republican primary for U.S. Senate in Ohio to replace the outgoing Rob Portman. Big win for J.D. Vance and big win for
President Trump.
No question about it. His late endorsement of Vance seems to have been the difference maker based on polling before and after endorsement. And he put his credibility on the line, did President Trump, and pulled J.D. Vance across the finish line.
Yeah, and J.D. Vance did thank President Trump yesterday.
The question presented in this primary was, do we want to have a border that protects our citizens? Do we want to ship our jobs to China or keep them right here in America for American workers and the American people? Do we want a Republican Party that stands for the donors who write checks to the Club for Growth, or do we want a Republican Party for the people right here in Ohio? Ladies and gentlemen, we just answered the question.
Well, and that's a pretty fair characterization, because he mentioned the Club for Growth specifically. Club for Growth, Senator Ted Cruz endorsing his chief opponent who finished second, Josh Mandel, and they were defeated, and there's some tension between Club for Growth and President Trump now based on the funding that Club for Growth provided for Mandel and some of the ads they ran. There's another race, too, that speaks to this. It's a little bit below the fold, but we know it here in Chicagoland. Northwest Indiana, the Republican primary for the 1st Congressional District in Indiana, where Jennifer Ruth Green handily beat Blair Milo for the nomination in a Northwest suburban district, if you will, in Indiana, that has been Dem for a long time. But in this year, with where the Hoosier State is going and Jennifer Ruth Green, that could be a pickup. But the Jennifer Ruth Green Blair Milo thing is interesting, because Blair Milo was this like rising star military. She was mayor of LaPorte, Indiana, very young age. And then she left the mayoralty to go work for Governor Holcomb. And she came back to run for this. Jennifer Ruth Green, also military, black woman as well. I actually met her when I spoke at the St. John, Indiana GOP thing a couple years back. She's very impressive. But Jennifer Ruth Green, more of a Trump outsider type. Blair Milo, especially after she went to work for Governor Holcomb, you know, perceived, I think, as more of an establishment type. And so a little bit of a similar dynamic there. Even though you're talking about two conservatives and so forth, it's just very interesting. We're starting to get an answer to the question of how much currency does a Trump endorsement, does adopting the sort of the Trump America First brand of populist politics have? And initially, from these primary results, it has significant currency. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Bill O'Reilly, who's still killing it. His latest is Killing the Killers, The Secret War Against Terrorists. He is the host of No Spin News, weeknights, 5 p.m. Chicago time at BillO'Reilly.com. Bill, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, guys. Nice to talk to you.
What was your read on some of the primary results yesterday, most notably Ohio?
Well, I think Ohio and Indiana are states that if Donald Trump would run again, he would
most likely carry, and economics is the reason. So there's no doubt that Donald Trump was successful economically as president, and the endorsement he makes then carries his name, obviously, into the polling place, into the ballot booth. And people are, it's not that long ago that the U.S. economy was vibrant and inflation was low. They remember. So I've always said, since Biden was inaugurated, it's going to be a comparison between what Biden does and what Trump does, and the people who attach themselves to either candidate will live or die. So I think Trump, you know, emerges a lot stronger, as you guys said, today than he was yesterday.
But moving on to Pennsylvania, he is endorsing Dr. Oz for the Senate there. Do you think that's going to be successful?
I don't follow the state by states, Amy. I know, obviously, about the race, but I don't get into it in a micro way. I've got too many things to do here on a national level and international level. But I think Oz has a good chance to win that primary. All the polls say that. Pennsylvania is a state. The Republican part of the state likes Trump. There's no doubt about it.
When you talk about things international and how they play in these state races, particularly for Senate and federal office, it's interesting. J.D. Vance was not a cheerleader for writing blank checks and making open-ended military commitments to Ukraine. Not opposed, obviously, to Ukraine's self-determination and protecting itself, but pivoted in the Senate race to talking about what we need to be doing here as part of sort of his America First vision. And I wonder if his success will translate into more skepticism about said funding and open-ended commitments to Ukraine among Republicans.
I don't think so. I don't think Ukraine is a top voting issue for Americans. But I think most people understand that Putin has to be taken down. I mean, that's one of the reasons that Killing the Killers it rocketed to number two on its first day out. I think we'll get to be number one today after talking with you two guys. That should put us over the top.
Absolutely.
Of course. I mean, we're moneymakers.
But Ukraine, you know, is not going to be a factor in anybody's vote. I don't even think abortion is going to be a factor in that many people's vote. It's all going to be about, are you stronger yourself economically and supporting your family now or 2 years ago? It's almost everything. And I don't know if pundits understand how much pain is being experienced in the average American home. And so Ukraine, abortion, all of these issues, yeah, people pay attention, but they're not deciders, as I say.
Oh, and speaking of the book, I mean, just sticking with that, since we're on this topic of America's national security interests, the angle you take as you give a broad look at America's war against terrorism over the last two decades.
The angle of the book is that we are secure against people who would kill us, but we don't know it. So there's nothing in this book that you know. You pick up Killing the Killers from page one, you're going to go, holy, you know what? Because we were able to talk with national security advisors from Bush the Younger all the way up to the end of Trump. We didn't get into Obama because we didn't get into Biden because it was too close. But we do talk about the screw-up in Afghanistan and how it killed U.S. service people. We got the inside story. But we in America are waging a ferocious war against the jihad, and we're killing hundreds of them. Even today, I mean, but no one knows it because the weaponry that we use, and this goes to Putin, is so sophisticated and so lethal, but it's space weaponry. And when these people are hit, when they're destroyed, they're vaporized. There's no reportage on it. It goes into a file, a top secret file. Well, we were able to get all that out. And that is why this book is going to be the discussion point for millions of people. And Putin knows we have these weapons. And it's a constraint on him. The Russians know. They don't have anything like we have. They have a lot of nukes. They can cause a lot of damage. But our sophisticated weaponry right now on drones, it's fearsome. And we describe how it's used, the actual trigger point for our weaponry in space is in Nevada. Nobody knows that. So, I urge people who are listening to us right now, check out Killing to Kill, as you will be happy you did.
What about President Trump's, aggressive posture against ISIS?
Well, Obama was aggressive, too. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, Trump was super aggressive and successful. But once Obama withdrew all the troops out of Iraq, which was a huge mistake, and the press didn't cover it because they covered for Obama, and then ISIS rose in ferocity, Obama was embarrassed. And the worst thing you can do to Barack Obama is embarrass him. And he came back, and they reorganized against ISIS and al-Qaeda under Obama, and a lot of terrorists went down. But Trump was the guy who really broke the back of ISIS, and ISIS is back now. They're reconstituting now because Biden's not paying attention, and so is al-Qaeda in Afghanistan.
And so when you talk about the number of terrorists that are being taken out that we don't know, and this is detailed in your book, Killing the Killers, so they're selective because, as recently as February of this year, there was this high-profile special forces operation that took out ISIS leader al-Qarashi in
right.
Syria. And so obviously that when you take out a head, they want the people to know because they want
absolutely.
To be demoralizing. But for the rank and file terrorist soldiers, it's less important that the public know.
Right. Exactly right. Excellent analysis. The federal government, when it gets a victory, then has to decide if it's worth the publicity because it stirs up recruitment for al-Qaeda and ISIS. But I'll give you a good example of something nobody knows. There is an active ground war going on in Africa now, and U.S. troops are involved in that, and U.S. troops get killed in Africa. And we describe a firefight with Boko Haram in the book that nobody's ever heard about. And about, I think it was 6 U.S. troops were killed. They come back, be buried in the United States, but there's no coverage of it. Their families know they're dead, but they don't know how or what happened. And this is the kind of stuff that happens on a daily basis. And Americans, they're just not, they're totally in the dark. If you ask, well, what is the U.S. government to protect you against terrorists? People go, well, they don't know. And I think we should know.
And are we all over the world, too, besides, fighting Boko Haram in Africa?
Yeah, wherever there is a jihad threat, an organized threat, then U.S. Special Forces and the CIA know about the threat. And then it's discussed, what should we do? What can we do with the government that the country, that the activity is taking place, and cooperate with us, that kind of thing. But it doesn't even matter anymore because we can vaporize these people from space. We don't have to put boots on the ground. We did have to do that with al-Baghdadi. We didn't have to do it with Soleimani, the head of the Revolutionary Guard in Iran, which right. is one of the strongest parts of Killing the Killers. We tracked that second by second, how they got that guy, Soleimani. It's amazing how they got him. Al-Baghdadi was a ground raid like bin Laden. And we opened with bin Laden because that anniversary was Monday
right.
Right.
of this week. And we have stuff in there that nobody's ever heard about the actual raid, about what happened. We put you right on the ground in Abbottabad when bin Laden got it.
Well, can you tell us something
some
that we don't know?
There was some reportage on it. So, excuse me?
Sorry for interrupting. Can you tell us something that we don't know about that raid?
Yeah.
A little teaser?
So when the SEALs went in there, they didn't know precisely how many people were in the compound. They knew that it wasn't just bin Laden and his wife. There were others. They didn't know how many others because what bin Laden had done was he had built this thing, and the drones couldn't see inside the buildings, and most of these people never went outside. They stayed inside. When they got there, the people who fought the hardest were the women in the compound, not the men. Bin Laden was a coward. He hid behind his wife. All right? The women in there had the AKs. And we take you through room by room. And they had to kill some of the women, in addition to Bin Laden and his son. Did you know that?
No, that's interesting. And so, you know, the secret war piece of this, too, like you were mentioning, the operation against Boko Haram in Africa. So what is the – you're talking about we should know these things. And I agree, and we should be spending more time talking about these things if we knew about them than we are you know, playing domestic politics with Homeland Security through disinformation governance boards and so forth. So what's your perspective then? Is that purposeful misdirection by the intelligence state that...
No, it's smart. It's smart. I mean, the bad guys know. So the bad guys know they can't use a telephone. No telephone. Because it'll be picked up. So they have to communicate by courier, and things like that. And Putin knows what we have. The Russian intel knows these weapons that we have in space could vaporize Vlad in what, 20 minutes? But that might cause a nuke war, so they don't do it. But it's a constraint on Putin. If we didn't have these weapons, Putin would have done more than he's done. And Xi in China with Taiwan... She knows. And then the Chinese can't compete with our weaponry. But it's not worth the United States making it a public display. The bad guys know, and obviously the U.S. intel. And U.S. intel is separate from Homeland Security. A lot of people don't understand that. Homeland Security is a fiasco right now at the border.
Yes.
It's a total fiasco. But the CIA and the NSA and all those people, they don't have anything to do with the border.
No, I understand. But here's the thing. You know, when you hear the phrase secret war, you think of, you know, Vietnam. And the question is one of the reasons these wars are secret because there's some dubious legality associated with them. Is that an issue?
The only dubious thing that we found is a coerced interrogation, which is outlawed now after Abu Ghraib, another anniversary last week. Is still going on, but we subcontract it out. Mm. So Americans don't do the coercive interrogation. We let other people do it. Mm-hmm. But it led directly to al-Baghdadi's death. Mm. All right? They had to use it. They did use it. Iraq did it. And they found out where Baghdadi was by coerced interrogation, and they waxed him.
He is Bill O'Reilly, host of No Spin News, weeknights 5 p.m. Chicago time. That's BillO'Reilly.com, where you pick up the show. And now pick up the new book, Killing the Killers, The Secret War Against Terrorists. Bill, thanks as always. Best of luck with the book.
All right, you guys will like it. Thanks for having me in. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Fed's two-day meeting concludes today. We're expecting that another interest rate hike. What will that mean against the backdrop of... job openings climbing to a fresh high in March after a continuation of the great resignation. Well, let's check in with our friend Steve Moore about that. Economist, author of Trumponomics, and most recently GovZilla. Steve Moore, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, guys. And by the way, I have a little bad news for you. It turns out that Nina Jankowicz, you know, who she's the new speech suppression czar
right.
by administration.
Yeah.
That the Dan and Amy show is hate speech, and you're going to be taken off the air. Yeah. Sorry about that.
Yeah. Is she going to sing it, though, like Mary Poppins?
We get that
you know,
a lot.
The Mary Poppins tune. Dan and Amy on AM 560 6500. No, that was really bad.
Yeah.
I can work
believe this, though? Isn't that amazing thing that they'd even, they're so brazen they would even try to do this? I mean, this isn't going to work, folks. But, I mean, the fact that they put these lunatics in these positions tells you a lot about this administration. And I got to, I mean, everywhere I go, I mean, people are so outraged by this power grab and this, you know, it's just an affront to the whole idea of the First Amendment. By the way, you know, they were saying that, you know, the Hunter Biden emails were a
Russian disinformation campaign. That's what exactly. Jankiewicz said. Yes. No,
So I enjoy your time fight. On the radio while you still have it.
Yes.
Thanks, Stephen Moore.
Well, give us some economic insights while we still have it. Okay. So the Fed rate hike today, you anticipate that?
Yeah, I do. And it's I hope they do, you know, 50 basis points. Look, I've been saying on your guys' show for a year now that the Fed is way behind the curve, and shame on them. They should have done this a year ago to stop this clear rising tide of inflation. The Fed has had the story wrong for the last year. They keep, remember, it was transitory and then it's going to go away and it's not going to be so bad. And it just kept going up and up and up. And so, yeah, the Fed has to take aggressive action. And, you know, we got a negative quarter of growth for the first quarter. That was negative 1.4%. So just so folks know, if we get a second quarter, that is, if this quarter turns out to be negative, then we would technically be in a recession, because recession is two straight quarters of negative growth. Now, I don't think this quarter is going to come in negative. It's going to be a low number, but it's, I don't think it's going to be a negative number. Here's the bottom line. And Art Laffer and I had a piece in the Wall Street Journal on this on Monday. When you let this inflation get worse and worse and worse, as has happened. It went from 3 to 4 to 5 to 7 to 8 to 8.5 to producer prices rising by 10%. It just takes down everything with it. It's like a wrecking ball. So it leads to lower real incomes. It's a killer of stocks. That's the point that Laffer and I made. You know, the stock market, the last time we had a, you know, high and long inflation, you know, the stock market lost 60% of its value in real terms. So the job number one to getting this economy moving again is to bring down inflation. And I talked to Art Laffer, by the way, yesterday, and he thinks that this is, you know, they've got to raise rates way more than this. I mean, back in the early 80s, to get inflation under control, you had Paul Volcker was then the chairman of the Fed. He raised rates very aggressively. And that was the way we finally killed the inflation, but, you know, way higher than what the Fed is talking about today.
Yeah. So, I mean, right. And your piece, we referenced your piece earlier in the week, yours and Laffer's. Paul Tudor Jones is, you know, hedge fund billionaire. He said yesterday, that you can't think of a worse environment than where we are right now for financial assets. Clearly you don't want to own bonds and stocks. So to your point,
right.
But he also said we're in an uncharted territory. And the point, one of the comparisons that you and Laffer provided was the comparison to the stagflation of the 70s. So are we in uncharted territory? Is this something even potentially worse than what we experienced in that time period?
Well, it's look, I want to give the economy its due. You mentioned the fact that we do have a great labor market right now. I mean, if you were looking for a job, they're out there. You know, the jobs are out there. Right? They are for now, right, unless the economy crashes. So, you know, you've got 10 million job openings out there. Anybody with any kind of useful skill, if you're a nurse or if you're an accountant, if you're a, you know, as any kind of science degree, if you've got a, if you're a plumber or you're a construction worker or a factory worker, those jobs are out there for people. So that's the good news. But this inflation, you know, the problem is what, you know, it causes, I'm really worried about, you mentioned stocks and bonds, Dan. I'm a little bit worried about this housing market. Now, the housing market has been on a tear. I mean, one of the most amazing bull markets in housing. And if you own a house like I do, it's great. I mean, our house keeps going up and up and up each month in terms of the value of the home. But then you've got this report that just came out, I think, on Tuesday, yesterday, that showed that the affordability index for housing is as bad as it's ever been. And they also found that monthly mortgage rates are near a record high, too. So what happens if this bubble bursts in housing? As the mortgage rates go up, you know, that's going to make it even harder for people to buy homes. So this is a bad situation, folks. And what's so frustrating is that I said this last week, I'll say it again. When Trump left office, we were at 1.5% inflation. 15 months later, we're at 8.5% inflation. Gee, do you think that might be related, Dan, to the $3 to $4 trillion that Biden has spent?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, back to mortgage rates. So 5% for a 30-year fix, that's, is that going to go down anytime soon, or is it only going to go up?
No. In fact, now the latest read is, you know, they're up to about five, in many markets, 5.5%. Okay. So they're, and it was only what, you know, 15 months ago that the mortgage rates were at 3.6, 3.7. So they're going, they're not coming down. Amy, I guarantee you they're not coming down. Now they may stay in that 5 to 6% range, which, you know, don't forget, again, for some historical context here, in 81, 82, the rates went up to, remember, mortgage rates went up to 17%. Oh, yeah. So, you know, 6% is still pretty low given what we had in the late 70s. But you just get this, you know, it is so frustrating because when you have an 8.5% inflation rate, it's like a hurdle, right? You have to, the economy has to grow it by 8.5% just to stay even. Your wage has to go up 8.5% just to stay even. All of these things are not keeping pace with this high hurdle, and it's causing, you know, a real havoc in the economy. If we don't get the inflation under control pretty soon, I do think we will go into a pretty severe recession.
Well, and here's the thing. The problem is, I mean, you say interest rates should be increased faster and on a grander scale. But we're not coming out of this the way that we did in the early 80s with Reagan,
right,
then providing incentives on the supply side.
Yes.
So if you did that, it just quickens the descent into recession, doesn't it?
Well, you make a really good point. I mean, look, there aren't any great choices right now. You know, it's like if you have a, you know, tumor in your body, you got to take the tumor out, right? And, you know, that you're going to have chemotherapy, and that's not a fun thing. So, you know, we've let this linger too long. And so you're exactly right, Dan. There's no great choices right now. But I'm here to tell you, unless we get the inflation down, it's going to be, it's only going to make it more and more painful. So
that's first order priority. First order priority is to squelch inflation, right?
But you are also right. You are exactly right that if we were to do a tax cut, or we deregulate or allow more drilling or anything that increases the supply of goods and services. And you're right. That's what Reagan did. It was the combination of bringing inflation down by raising rates, but also the tax cuts, the deregulation efforts, the free enterprise policies of Reagan really unleashed the economy. That's not coming from this administration. My God, you know, last week, just think in the last week or so. First, you know, Biden says he wants to relieve $1.5 trillion of student loans, which means, you know, run the debt up another $1.5 trillion because it means taxpayers are going to pay for it. And then, you know, Schumer says, oh, the only way to bring inflation down is to get rid of the Trump tax cuts. I'm like, what planet are these people on? I mean, they don't have one degree of sensible economic policies from any of these people. And, you know, then oh, we're going to go after the oil. How about this one? We're going to bring oil prices down by increasing the taxes on the oil companies.
Right. And so with yesterday's election.
Explain that one.
Well, I mean, there's you know, come on. There's no explanation. You know what the explanation is.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, explain Ford making a multi-billion dollar investment in Rivian that resulted in a net loss of $3.1 billion.
Right.
So, you know, it's all politics and government and big business playing politics because they think long term that partnership, you know, is going to be fruitful.
Yeah. Let me just interrupt. I mean, because you just reminded me of something that I wanted to say on your guys' show, that, you know, here we have this inflation where the match that lit this forest fire of rising prices, in my opinion, was these trillions of trillions and trillions of dollars of spending. And by the way, it began under Trump. Trump had passed, you know, this major $1 trillion spending bill before he left the White House. And then they put $3 trillion on top of that. And so just to give you a sense of how clueless these people are in Washington, even the Republicans, Dan and Amy, want to pass a $300 billion giveaway. It's a corporate welfare giveaway for Intel and companies like that so they can make chips. I'm like, come on. I mean,
yeah.
We don't need corporate welfare. We just need to get the economy back, you know, low taxes, less regulation, And these guys really think that more government spending is going to stimulate our businesses.
Well, this is the interesting thing, and it's the interesting thing about J.D. Vance's win in Ohio last night, too, is on the one hand, you know, America first, there's a lot of positive components to it. But one of the negatives is this profligate spending if you're spending it domestically. And I wonder if J.D. Vance really represents a break from that, or if Trump continues to be a kingmaker, if we're going to see a whole new crop of Republicans that feel like they can spend in an unrestrained manner just a little bit less than the Democrats.
Yeah. So, by the way, this is the first time I heard that J.D. won last night.
Yeah.
And so was it a big win or
8 points?
Yeah, 8 points.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, and Trump did endorse J.D. Vance, and that really helped. I mean, that, there's no question that Trump's endorsement of J.D. Really helped him. He might have won otherwise, but it clearly helped him a lot. And, yeah, I like the America First agenda. I just don't like this idea. I mean, I do think a president should put America first. That's something this president does not do. He does not put America first. But this idea that you put America first by subsidizing your businesses and through tariffs and things like that, that's not a very good strategy. The way you put America first is by using the free market system. And, you know, our mutual friend, Dan, because I think you met him as well, Milton Friedman. I knew Milton Friedman pretty well up in the last years of his life. You know, he used to say, you don't fight a subsidy with a subsidy.
Right.
So, you know, the Chinese are subsidizing their chip makers. So he's, oh, well, we're going to subsidize our chips, you know, and that's not the right economic model. Come on. I mean, with that $300 billion, we could cut our corporate tax rate and help all businesses.
He is Steve Moore, economist, Trumponomics, and Govzilla author. Steve, thanks as always.
Okay, guys, have a great week. Take care.
Thanks, you too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, the takeaways from yesterday's primaries in Ohio and to a lesser extent. But as we mentioned in our conversation with Bill O'Reilly, an important extent, that congressional primary in Northwest Indiana with Jennifer Ruth Green defeating Blair Milo to potentially set up a pickup opportunity for Republicans in the Hoosier state. That has relevance to the conversation of what the landscape is providing right now. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Matt Mayer. He is the president of OpportunityOhio.org. Matt, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, let me just give us your take on J.D. Vance's victory yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, I think clearly the Donald Trump endorsement 2 weeks ago greatly benefited J.D. By pushing him, kind of separating him from the field enough to secure a strong win. Clearly shows Ohio is a Trump state. And so that if you want to be successful politically in Ohio, you're gonna need to not have kind of a never Trump mentality. You're gonna have to realize that it's either Trump or the policies that Trump endorsed really are well received by Ohioans.
But you know, the interesting thing about yesterday, and I know it was a three-way primary, so maybe that muted some of the disaffection with DeWine, but on the Republican side, the gubernatorial primary, there was the thought, at least early on, that maybe the Congressman Renacci would be able to make a play on DeWine, because I mean, DeWine's not exactly a pro-Trump, you know, a rock-rib pro-Trumper.
No, so DeWine only winning with 48% of the vote as an incumbent up for re-election is troubling for he and his team, and for his Lieutenant Governor John Husted, who has 2026 ambitions. Those ambitions are going to be tempered quite a bit by that result. And, you know, but look, Jim Renacci is a very flawed candidate. He's had long-term ethical issues that have plagued him, and, you know, he's not a very dynamic guy. You know, Joe Blystone was also in the race. Joe got over 20% as well. I think combined they beat DeWine in terms of number of votes. But I think what that shows you is DeWine could have lost this year in a primary if the right candidate with the good message, messenger, organization, and money would have gotten in. But no one did, I think, that could have beaten him because, you know, DeWine sits on about $100 million personal fortune that he could have thrown at the race that nobody else could match.
Right.
What about in the general election against the former Dayton mayor? Is that going to be highly contested race?
He'll win by 10 points or more. You know, Nan Whaley is unknown even among Democrats. She's not a very charismatic campaigner. She's very progressive, which won't sell well in Ohio, across Ohio. So that'll be an easier race for him to win. And then J.D. Vance will have a tough race against Tim Ryan. Tim Ryan is blue-collar kind of guy. He's from the Akron-Canton area, sells a good story, campaigns well. But I think, you know, Vance will be able to win that race, assuming he doesn't make any major pitfalls.
Yeah, Tim Ryan is somewhat interesting, although he's a bit obnoxious, at least for my taste. I mean, he's just so, like, you know, union thuggish in his rhetoric. He's almost a caricature. But he did take on Pelosi for speaker, so that gives him some sort of independent credential. He's not part of the, you know, radical left. And he had this ill-fated run for president, too. You still think, I mean, it's basically if that's the case for Tim Ryan, who would be perhaps the best chance for a Democrat to win statewide in Ohio, is Ohio just a red state, or at least a Trump red state right now? And there's just no competition at the state level if you're aligned with, you know, the America First agenda, as it were?
It mostly is. But everyone needs to keep in mind that in between the bookends of Trump's 8% win in 2016 and his 8% win in 2020, Sherrod Brown won statewide by 6%, which was a repeat of his 6% win 6 years earlier. So,
yeah.
So a Democrat can win in Ohio, but they need to be, you know, they need to be blue collar oriented. They need to peel back the blue collar labor union guys that have pulled over to Trump, and they need to go up against a flawed candidate. But they can win. But yeah, I think by and large, you know, Ohio is red, but a blue player can win if it's the right dynamic during that race.
Do you see any scenario in which Ohio would be in play for Democrats in 2024?
I don't, because if Trump runs, I think he'll win Ohio. If he doesn't run, I think Ron DeSantis would likely be the nominee, and I think he would win Ohio. And I don't see on the Democrat side, there just doesn't appear to be the talent, I think, to pull off an Ohio win. Could be wrong, but, you know, I think you saw in the last primary that they had. I mean, look, they went with Joe Biden because he was the best of the bunch, and he's not very good, and he only won because of the mass amount of rigging that went on leading up to the election, and then some of the shenanigans that happened during the election. You know, it's awful hard. It's amazing Trump didn't lose by more than 43,000 votes in three states, given 5 years of relentless 90% media coverage that was negative, the Russia hoax collusion stuff, you know, all that combined attack, the suppression of Hunter Biden and Joe Biden's corruption. I mean, all of that, you know, essentially allowed a fairly weak Democrat to squeak by a win. And I don't see that happening in 2024.
And some of that corruption is going to be displayed in the movie 2000 Mules, which is out tonight, and other people, you know, they do a virtual premiere on Saturday, May 7th, because our station and our company, Salem, produced that movie. Are you going to be seeing it, Matt?
A good friend of mine got tickets for, I think, tonight's showing. So I think we're supposed to be going to the show tonight here in Dublin. That, and along with Molly Hemingway's great book, Rigged, that is just like, you know, if you read that, that's where you talk about, you know, the Zuck Bucks. All the stuff that happened leading up to the election that made it very difficult for any Republican to win, let alone Trump.
Is the Kasich sort of DeWine model of the Republican Party in Ohio, is that all but dead now?
I think it's all but dead, asterisk. Problem is, the way Ohio politics work at the top of the ticket statewide level is the establishment folks that are all in those statewide offices, they just play musical chairs. So,
yeah.
You know, the AG or the Secretary of State or the auditor, they're going to likely try to run for governor. And we've not seen somebody step up who can kind of really take the Trump mantle, secure enough funding to kind of beat the establishment at their game, because they get well funded, and it's hard then to beat them, as Mike DeWine has shown. I mean, he had a very weak campaign, but it's hard to beat an establishment figure in Ohio unless you have some money coming in. And, you know, JD had Peter Thiel and all the funds that Peter put in, so that was very beneficial. Without those funds, JD probably wouldn't have won.
Well, yeah, that's a good point, too. Yeah. Thiel Super PAC, yeah.
The friends that I have in Ohio were not pleased at all with DeWine and how he handled COVID. And I thought that there was rumblings that he might be replaced even as an incumbent.
Well, here's what's interesting. So DeWine has, like, you know, he's one of the most popular governors in America, along with Hogan Larry Hogan out in Maryland and Charlie Baker up in Minnesota. But what's misleading about that is Massachusetts. The popularity does not come from Republicans for all three of those men.
Right.
The popularity comes from Democrats and a smaller chunk of Republicans. But among Republicans, you know, he's not very well liked, and you can see that by, you know, getting reelected. I mean, he shouldn't have been primaried if he was strong, and to then only win 48% is a pretty ugly signal if you're Mike DeWine.
So, I mean, you obviously survey the landscape outside of Ohio, thinking of the Midwest, where you've got other opportunities as well as competitive races. Thinking of like Ron Johnson in Wisconsin. Are there lessons from what we saw in this primary for Republicans in places like Michigan and Ohio, maybe even Illinois? I mean, Michigan and Wisconsin, and maybe even Illinois.
Well, Illinois, God love you guys, but you know, with Cook County in Chicago, it's awful hard for you guys to do much of anything until that cesspool drains a bit of all the progressive left voters there. I think my biggest concern for this cycle is going to be Pennsylvania and that open seat in Pennsylvania.
Right.
Simply because of the Pittsburgh Philly vote totals that they can run up. And that worries me deeply about losing that seat. Cause right. That would be a flip, for the left. And, I think we're going to take Nevada. I think we're going to take back Georgia. I think Ron keeps the seat in Wisconsin. Arizona will be interesting. You know, Mark Kelly's, you know, doing his best to look like the moderate. And you just have to wonder, if there's a red wave, can he survive that? And if he does, it'll be barely. But that'll be an interesting seat to look at. But Pennsylvania is the one that I worry about the most, just given the dynamics of those two big cities.
In the Vance Mandel primary and the other candidates too, it was competitive. There's a lot of focus on in the closing days on Trump, his endorsement, America First top line. I wonder how important you think, and was there much distinction between the candidates on some of the cultural battles that are being fought, like school curriculum and boys and girls sports and those sorts of things? Did those issues play a significant factor in the race?
You know, not at all, not at all. And even on the non-social issue issues, there wasn't much of a gap between any of the candidates. And that's where, you know, you could see the appeal of Donald Trump's endorsement was beneficial, right? Because it separated JD from the other, from Josh Mandel and from Matt Dolan and Jane Timken, of course, Mike Gibbons, who put in $17 million of his own funds to try to win the seat. Because all those candidates were fairly close on the issues. The one distinction between them was, you know, Matt Dolan is viewed as a never Trump guy. He had a little bit of a surge over the weekend, and I think that was mostly due to, you know, the group of establishment voters, 55 and older, who kind of just got sick of the Trump stuff. And so, that, you know, enough of them started pushing his button, which rose, you know, he rose at the poll. But then I think it shows there's a ceiling to that never Trump vibe in Ohio. So if you're going to run in that lane, you probably need to understand you're probably going to tap out at about 25%. So only way you win is if there's a very crowded primary that allows you to win at 25%. Otherwise, you know, it's not going to sell well here in Ohio.
He is Matt Mayer, president of OpportunityOhio.org. Matt, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka, today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I enjoyed this headline of an op-ed in The Atlantic. Mrs. Jobs' leftist outlet there. The conservatives aren't just ending Roe. They're delighting in it.
Oh.
Mm.
Don't see that happening.
No, I am delighting in it. Why? Okay. Why wouldn't I? Why shouldn't pro-lifers delight in the ending of Roe? If I was alive in the 1860s, I would have delighted in the passage of the 13th and 14th Amendments to overturn Dred Scott, too. You see, because I delight in the revocation of any law that treats someone as another's property. Is that confusing? So I shouldn't be happy about that? Oh, what do you do in the face of the revocation of a law that treats someone as another's property? Delight or decry? Well, we've seen from the left a lot of decrying. And we see from the left the combination of the let's wreck the court, abolish a filibuster so we can wreck the court. And then we also have offerings from constitutional scholars like Cori Bush, a newly minted socialist spice girl from St. Louis, who says, you know, hey, just do what we did with like Obamacare and what we tried to do with the vax mandates. Just go around the legislative process, go mm-hmm. around the courts and just do it by administrative fiat.
The president could have the FDA issue regulations to expand access to medication abortion. You know, we need to bring that back into the conversation so that pregnant people could have access to a two-pill regimen safely and be able to end a pregnancy at home up to 10 weeks. You know, also, you know, what about the Department of Health and Human Services encouraging states to use their own Medicaid funds, of course, which are not governed by the Hyde Amendment? Use that to cover abortion services. So there are options. We need to talk about all of them.
Pregnant people.
Right. Because you don't want to offend a pregnant man.
No. The birthing.
Because he's expecting Netflix show.
A lot of different birthing persons out there. Yeah.
No, of course you guys everyone should be celebrating who's been pro-life and has been fighting for this. But I think both sides agreed how it was leaked was wrong.
Well, I don't agree that both sides agree because I think about this. If it turns, you know, some people said, well, it could have been some clerk for one of the conservative justices who's upset by Roberts not siding with the majority. Yeah, I doubt it. That sort of starts from the ridiculous premise of there's extremes on both sides. No. It's not the same.
You think the sides are the same? Clerk from Sonia Sotomayor.
There's a theory about a clerk at Sotomayor's office. There's a theory about a clerk in Breyer's office. I don't know, but here's what I do know: if it was a clerk from a conservative justice, that clerk's legal career is over.
Mm-hmm.
If it was a clerk from Sotomayor or Breyer or some pro-abort justice's office, that clerk is going to be a celebrity. See the difference?
But you still think they'd get disbarred.
If it was a clerk from Thomas or Alito or ACB, yeah, probably. Breyer, Sotomayor, Kagan, I'm not so sure. That's not how it works anymore in America. And frankly, the overturning of Roe v. Wade is a blow for how it used to work in America when we respected the rule of law and we didn't make it up as we go along. And as Alito pointed out in that draft opinion that was leaked, we didn't say, you know, it's somewhere in the Constitution without having to be a little bit more specific about where that somewhere is if you're going to create a right out of whole cloth as Blackmun did in 73. And by the way, you know, the level of understanding of our republic is, you know, never ceases to underwhelm. You're talking about, give you an example, Pramila Jayapal, another newly minted socialist spice girl from Washington State who's in leadership. Listen to what she had to say on CNN yesterday.
But these justices are acting like this is somehow something that they have the right to change. They do not have the right to change this, which has been settled law for two generations now, of people who have grown up, who have gone through their 20s, in the firm belief that they can make these decisions about their own bodies.
Bad law. I mean, Dred Scott was settled law for a dozen years. Plus, E.V. Ferguson was settled law for 56 years. So it shouldn't have been overturned. Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal, shouldn't have been overturned, Representative Jayapal. I wish we could have these conversations, force people who know so little into having to defend themselves in such a way that they get intellectual pushback as opposed to being allowed to exist in silos like CNN or Fox News, for that matter. But that's not the world we live in, unfortunately. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by our friend Andy McCarthy, former Chief Assistant U.S. Attorney, Manhattan, contributing editor at National Review, author of Ball of Collusion, the plot to rig an election and destroy a presidency. That's a bestseller. Andy, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning. How are you?
Morning. As somebody who is a barrister and a constitutional scholar and
all-around good guy.
Reads, just in general. You must be highly entertained as well as mildly disturbed by some of the histrionics you're hearing on the law from people who are charged with making it.
Well, I hadn't heard some of the stuff that you just played until listening through it. I would think Representative Jayapal ought to be happy since, now more people will actually be born and make it into their 20s, which is that's what she's concerned about. But, you know, as you point out, it's like self-evident nonsense. It's these guys are all result-oriented. So, you know, this is an outcome they don't like. So now they're suddenly I don't know if they could spell stare decisis, but they suddenly believe in it. And, right. You know, the next case around, when the left throws out some, you know, long held precedent, they'll be telling us about enlightened liberty or something. So, you know, whatever.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to what color scheme the stare decisis ribbon will be that's forthcoming.
Yeah, well, you know, I just the one thing I would add to what you said about the suspect set is I would just, if I were an investigator, you know, you have to start someplace. And obviously you try to figure out the circle of people who had access to this opinion. But what makes a conservative justice or a conservative law clerk conservative would cut against doing this.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, that's for the very reason that I think you rightly say that the legal profession, which is very left to center, the reason they would celebrate a radical leftist clerk who did this and castigate a conservative clerk who did it is because on our side, you know, we believe in norms and traditions and understand the importance of the court being able to have deliberations with confidentiality, and that's a critical aspect of the institution. And on their side, they want to burn down the institutions, you know, to the extent that they block them from the things that they want to achieve. So it's much more likely that a leftist clerk would do this simply because the leftist clerk is not only wired that way, but would be celebrated for it in a way that would not happen on the right.
But don't you think if he or she is exposed, regardless if they're a liberal or conservative, don't you think they'll be disbarred?
I sure hope so. I mean, I would like to see a more, and I don't want to criticize the justices because I don't know if they've said anything in the last 24 hours that I haven't heard. But I thought it was welcome for Chief Justice Roberts to come out and say what he said yesterday and put out that statement. I'd really like to see all 9 justices come out and say that and say that, you know, we are going to get to the bottom of who did this. And that this isn't a conservative thing. It's not a liberal thing. It's about the court as an institution and the integrity of its processes. I think that would be a welcome statement from the progressives, but I haven't heard it yet. And I don't want to criticize them because maybe they've made it and I haven't heard it, but I sure haven't heard it.
Well, what Supreme Court justices do you think will change their vote maybe because of all this outrage and the marches in certain cities?
I really hope, Amy, that none of them do. To me, if one comma of that opinion gets changed, and look, when I write my columns, I change them after they're published sometimes, you know, if I see something that's wrong. And I'm one of these people who, like, works up till the last second tweaking and you know, writing and rewriting. So I understand that you want to do that because you really want to get it right up to the minute that you issue it. But in this instance, I think it would be really bad for the court if a comma got changed. You know, I think anything that gets changed, if it's at all meaningful, including the vote tabulation, is going to be indicative of what happened here working. That is, this was leaked in order to intimidate the justices, and if they then turn around and change the vote or change the opinion, which is a brilliant opinion, then it looks like it worked, which means you invite more of it.
Well, first of all, you would, if one of the five changed their vote, then they're done as a justice. And they probably, if there's enough Republicans in office, they probably would face impeachment. Because how can you change your legal opinion based on public pressure? What possible rationale would there be other than that? And so then what is the, if you're just going to go wherever the most pressure is applied, then you're no longer an officer of the court as far as anybody serious is concerned. I don't see how that could come to pass.
Well, but you did hear it said any number of times yesterday that opinion is not an opinion yet, right?
Yeah.
They were very emphatic to say that until it's issued as a formal opinion, it doesn't mean anything. It's just a draft. So,
yeah,
what's the point of saying that if it's not still in play? And look, I agree with you that if anyone changed their vote, they would come in for, you know, a lot of rebuke, but whether they be, I don't think anybody'd be thrown off the court for that or impeached.
Well,
what they would say is they changed their mind.
Yeah. Yeah. That, I mean,
Chief Justice Roberts changed his mind in the
Obamacare
case.
Well, yeah, I know.
He was the majority until he wasn't.
I know, but the combination of any of the five that are, part of the perceived majority on the case and where we know they are based on this matter from their jurisprudence, some of them from their writings and other public pronouncements, boy, that would be a very difficult sea change to explain.
Yeah, well, you've raised now the thing that I'm most concerned about, which is I think it was right for the court to explain to people that a draft opinion is not an opinion until it's formally issued. And it was right for Roberts to say that the draft opinion was authentic. But the problem with all that is every second that they don't issue it now as a formal opinion, those five justices have a target on their back.
Yeah.
And,
the territory.
I don't want to be hysterical here, but I'm worried about their, you know, the fact that they're going to be subject to intimidation. They're already being subject to, rhetorical intimidation,
right.
But I worry that it gets worse than that. The way things are nowadays, I worry about that.
Well, I think that's fair. And I mean, I agree with you. I retweeted your tweet from the other day when this first broke that night. You said that basically the opinion should be released post haste. And I agree with you for the very reason that you're explaining. To the extent, drafting and dissents and so forth. Well, that can all come after release the majority opinion. Right. In its current form. If you want to brush it up and make sure there are no typos, that's fine, but let's get it out.
Yep. Yeah, I just think that at this point, it's not fair to those five justices. And this is where, I think the progressive justices could make a difference. If you really care about the integrity of the court, you care about its viability as an institution, you care about its processes, you close ranks now and say, look, we disagree about the substantive issue, but we are shoulder to shoulder in protecting the court, and we need to get the opinion out now.
Mm-hmm.
And if the progressive justices said that, even though they lost, that would be very admirable. And I must say I would think well of them for doing it. But I think it's essential that it be done because these justices now, you know, until this thing gets issued as a formal opinion, the crazies out there are going to be putting all kinds of pressure on these guys.
Well, I mean, and Roberts, who's, you know, Mr. Finger in the Wind, he should recognize that more so than anybody.
Yeah, and if he doesn't, I he's a smart enough guy that he's got to recognize it. But he's got a lot of people around him who obviously recognize it, including, I would assume, the marshal of the court. But the court has a lot of, back and forth with security personnel in the government. As we know, the Supreme Court's a highly secured, protected building. So the Chief Justice is the chief administrator of the court in addition to everything else. So I'm sure the security personnel have to be telling him that.
He is Andy McCarthy, former chief assistant U.S. attorney in Manhattan, contributing editor of National Review and author of the bestseller Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Andy, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Dan, Amy, have a great day.
Thanks, you too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.